Good morning.
Happy New Year.
Hopefully you had a really good time last night. I ushered in the new year by sleeping. It's wonderful. So I had no idea what was going on. So if you have a Bible, turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 5. We'll be there this morning. We're taking a little break from Romans. I don't know about you, but one of my favorite shows that I really enjoyed watching is the popular sitcom The Office. I don't know if you've ever watched any of it or heard of it. It is a show that is run like a documentary that a paper company's regional office in Pennsylvania. This office is run by this man named Michael Scott. He is like one of the main characters in the show, who has this insatiable desire to be loved, to be respected, and accepted by all his colleagues and employees. But he can be incredibly selfish at times, socially awkward, and really inappropriate, right? This is a guy that is one of the main characters on The Office. So, in one of the episodes, he poses this question. Would I rather be feared or loved? Easy. Both. I want people to be afraid of how much they love me. What makes this quote kind of amusing is Michael Scott's trying to reconcile two of these seemingly diametrically opposed feelings. And he's also like incredibly like self-centered at the same time. We've been taught that fear and love cannot coexist. Right? It feels like fear and love are two things that don't really mix well together, like oil and water. What I wanted to do is I wanted to kind of take a step back to see that this is actually not a contradictory, but a paradox instead. So, this morning I wanted to, as we were in 2 Corinthians, I want to see what Apostle Paul thinks about this. Apostle Paul is the guy that wrote this book. And how does fear and love play in our faith in Jesus Christ? So in the spirit of the new year, and in New Year resolutions, I want us all this morning to make two spiritual resolutions. The first one is to deepen our holy fear for God, and the second one is to properly respond to Christ's love for us. So we can kind of wrap this up in one nice, neat sentence, one nice, neat gift. Our goal this morning is for us to see that because of the cross, we should faithfully obey and follow Jesus out of holy fear and because of Christ's love. Christ's cross, we should faithfully obey and follow Jesus out of two things, holy fear and out of response to his love for us. Alright, so we are in 2 Corinthians. You should hopefully be in chapter 5, and we'll be reading from verse 11 through verse 15. It says this: therefore, knowing the fear of the Lord, we persuade others. But what we are is known to God, and I hope it is known also to your conscience. We are not commending ourselves to you again, but giving you cause to boast about us, so that you may be able to answer those who boast about outward appearance and not about what is in the heart. For if we are besides ourselves, it is for God. If we are in our right mind, it is for you. For the love of Christ controls us. Because we have concluded this, that one has died for all, therefore all have died. And he died for all, that those who live might no longer live for themselves, but for him, for him who for their sake died and was raised. Right, so I want to give a little background on what's going on, a little background on 2 Corinthians, a little bit of a background about what's going on. Alright, so, just track with me for a minute, alright? This thing kind of like, is this my time? I was like really, maybe I should just stop using this. Okay, great. Alright, so, Paul is writing to the Corinthian church. And this Corinthian church, them and Paul have some history. Alright, so the church is based in Corinth, And Paul actually was the one that went there and shared the gospel to them, spent time with them, built up a church that he essentially planted a church in Corinth. And then he left and kept on, you know, kept on doing what he was doing. He was going, sharing the gospel. So Paul and Corinth have this very complicated relationship because as they wanted to come back later on, he finds out that there's people that went into that church and essentially start talking smack about Paul. Right? He's like saying that Paul was kind of crazy. He suffered too much. Like, look at this guy, man. Like, everywhere he goes, he's like, he gets persecuted. He all these things happen to him. He can't be an apostle because look at all this stuff happening. And so they start taking this church and turning them kind of from Paul. So Paul writes four letters to this church. He writes four of them. The first one and the third one are lost. Right, so he's tried to visit this church before. We see in Acts, and it just was bad news. So he's just like, all right, maybe it's best I just kind of like leave for a little bit, because a lot of people in that church just didn't really care for him. He sent Timothy and Titus there before, kind of get to check up, and he started writing to this church because they've been living in a lot of sin. They're just a jacked up church. So the first letter he writes is lost. The second letter is what we find in 1 Corinthians. The third letter is lost again, and the fourth letter is what we have right here in 2 Corinthians. So I know it's kind of confusing. He writes four letters, but we only keep two of them. Well, not keep two of them, we only have two of them. And so what we find out in the letters, if we read 1 Corinthians, read 2 Corinthians, we find out there's a few kind of, they're really jacked up. First of all, everyone's like split into different factions. People want to like choose different people to follow, and they're like, I follow Paul, I follow Apollos, I follow Christ, and they're all split up. There's no unity. Right? Second of all, we see that they're really like full of themselves, so they're like really trying to one up each other spiritually. So you got this game going on at church, like who's more spiritual, so who can like speak tongues the most, or who can do this the best, and who's great, and who's great at this. So they're trying to one up one another. And then we also see that they don't really. They kind of ignore some of the problems in their church. They let some of the things going on there, they just kind of let it slide. And so, for example, one of the things that they let slide is they know that one of the brothers in their church was actually sleeping with his stepmom. And they're like, that's cool, you know, don't worry about it. Like, we don't need to address that issue. And Paul writes them like this scathing letter, like, dude, you need to shapen up. And then he comes back and writes the second letter that we have, and it's probably one of the most emotional, passionate, like heartfelt letters from Paul. He clearly cares for these people. He loves them. But they're so jacked up. And so that's kind of where we are at. And he's trying to defend his apostleship. He's trying to defend that like God has actually called him to do this stuff. And he's spending time because there's people that go to this, that are in the church that are just kind of speaking down on Paul and saying that he can't really be like sent by Jesus because of all these things that we talked about. Right? And so Paul is writing to them defending his apostleship. He's writing to them to get them to like turn from all these things. It's like, this is what the gospel really is. You're losing focus. You're not being united. You're kind of like just going crazy. And so, I want to kind of stop for a second and just kind of like, it's easy for us, like looking back into history and judging them. Because like, the Corinthians and this church in Corinth have like this terrible reputation, right? Everyone's like, man, that church is a jacked up church. And what I want is to kind of just, before we move on a little bit, like how amazing it is that Paul actually still spends time writing to this church. How amazing it is that he still starts off each of these letters by calling them the saints who are here in this church. Like, Paul doesn't give up on them. And it's easy for us to look back at this church. And what I wanted to do is not to look back on this church and kind of feel a little, like, good about ourselves, like, man, I can't believe that church is so jacked up. But to realize that we have more in common with the church in Corinth than with Jesus Christ at times. And how amazing it is, and just like how gracious it is that he has, that Jesus has this patience for this church and for these people to lovingly bring them back. And I wanted to just kind of be like, that's pretty cool. That no matter how jacked up this church is, or any of the people that Paul has been writing to, because a lot of these letters, like we find in the Bible, that like in the New Testament, Paul is writing to try to confront a lot of like terrible things that are going on. But God is so gracious to them. So just kind of let you know, like historically, we've been a screwed up people. And I know that in some sense it's like, oh, that kind of sucks, but in another sense it should give us some hope and going, wait a minute, like, God is so patient with us, because historically we have just been constantly messing up, like our forefathers, our spiritual forefathers still couldn't get it right. And so, I just want to remind us this morning as we start the new year, that some of you might not feel like you got things together. And some of you might feel like my life is in turmoil, and that my walk with Jesus is in turmoil, and maybe like hearing about this church, like, yeah, I feel like I'm jacked up inside as well. I just want to remind us again this morning, quoting a pastor from Dallas, Matt Chandler, that it is okay to not be okay, right? And as Pastor Josh says all the time here, and as we kind of really want to remind everyone here again this morning, that you know, the church is not for perfect people. No perfect people are allowed. It's for the broken. It's for anybody who feels like, I don't have things together. This is where we belong. And it's okay for us to not be okay. So if you don't feel okay today, that's fine. It's okay. But also reminded at the same time, like, you know, it is not okay to stay that way. And I'm hoping that we can move towards what it looks like to follow Jesus. All right, so that's all free. That's all free, because I want to just, like, Corinthians are always, like, the jacked up church with a terrible reputation. All right, so leading up to this passage, Paul is writing about, about a heavenly mindset. All right, so in chapter 5, the first part of chapter 5, so chapter 5, 1 through 10, he's writing about a heavenly mindset. So Paul is essentially, if we're going to kind of wrap that, just 10 verses up, essentially what he's saying is he's reminding the Corinthians that there's more to things than this earthly life, right? This is not our permanent home, that we should live our lives with a heaven-minded mentality. That's kind of what chapter 5, verse 1 through 5 is all about. It's like living with a heavenly-minded mentality. And so we're going to kind of back up a little bit. I'll read to give a little bit of like background, and so we can kind of set what's going on. So we'll just read from verse 6. We won't read the whole thing. He goes, so we are always of good courage. We know that while we are at home in the body or away from the Lord, for we walk by faith, not by sight. Yes, we are of good courage, and we should rather be away from the body and at home with the Lord. So whether we are at home or away, we make our aim to please Him. For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, so that each one may receive what is due for what he has done in the body, whether good or evil. So what Paul is essentially saying in that passage is going, all right, so earth is not all that it is. Eventually, we will be back at home with the Lord. That there's more than just this. But he goes, when we are, as believers, when we are back at home with the Lord, we are all going to have to approach the judgment seat of Christ. And he's going to evaluate everything we have done, whether good or evil. Now, I mean, so he's like, this is what's going to happen. Well, for every single person is going to approach the judgment seat of Christ, and he's going to evaluate them. And so with that in mind, and we'll talk a little bit about that, but with that in mind, he starts verse 11, goes, therefore knowing the fear of the Lord. And that's kind of where we're going to stop right here. Like, this is why he has a fear for the Lord. And so our first point here is going that, what does it look like for us to live in holy fear? Right, that's kind of like our very first resolution that we want to talk about today, right? Living a life of holy fear. Living a life of holy fear. And so what is happening? What is going on here is that this holy fear is driving Paul to do what he's doing, right? He's driving Paul to persuade others. He's driving Paul to share the gospel to the ends of the earth. This holy fear. But this fear, I think a lot of times when we think of fear, when we hear this word fear, we think that like Paul is like talking about like terror or being terrified. Or maybe for us when we like fear something, you're just scared. Right? You're scared out of your mind. But that's not what Paul's talking about. Paul's not talking about that type of fear. See, Paul is not saying that he's afraid like where his salvation lies. Right? He's not afraid that I'm going to go up to Jesus hoping that I'll be saved or hoping Jesus will accept me. Like, he has full confidence in that. He's not afraid about that. He's not afraid about where he is in terms of like his relationship with Jesus. So what is this fear? This fear is more of recognizing who God is and who he is. Right? It is what we call, a lot of people, like what it will be defined as like this reverence or this awe or this honor. Right? It is not a fear of terror or dread. It is not a fear that's derived because he believes God is evil or mean or vindictive or angry. It's actually just recognizing that God is just way more holy than I recognize or realize, and I am way more sinful than I give myself credit for. He sees the great divide between him and God, that God is supremely more moral than he's like ever imagined. And with that, it strikes a response of reverence and awe and honor and respect and just like nervousness. I don't know about you, but have you ever thought about what it would look like for you to stand before God? A lot of times I think about that. I think about things like, what if I end up dying tonight and I find myself in front of Christ when I open my eyes again? Would I feel like the things that I've done on earth was like pleasing to him? Like, would I feel like, man, I was faithful every single, like with every single thing I've done, I was faithful? Or would I feel like, dang God, I wasted it. I'm so sorry. I saw oftentimes when I kind of like have this, I have these thoughts and I kind of think about them, like, what would I be? And a lot of times I go, God, give me more time because I feel like I am not, I don't recognize your goodness enough in my life. Right? And so Paul is going like, this is what he recognizes. He recognizes God is so supremely, like, more holy than he has ever imagined. And it's like, it brings this deep longing to want to just like fear him and obey him. It's not a coincidence that we see in the Old Testament, like in Proverbs chapter 1 verse 7, when he says, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. See, holy fear forces us to evaluate our motivation. It forces us to depend on Jesus. It's recognizing who he really is and who I really am. Fear of God is not a microscope that makes something small large. It's a telescope that what we see as far away, and we see for what it truly is. Is recognizing in my own life that I don't give God the credit and due that he really deserves. All right, do you have that type of holy awe and reverence for the Lord? Is this fear, this holy fear, that what it does is drives you to obedience? And so I want us to kind of just stop and think about for a minute, like, what does that even really mean? Like, have I ever experienced this holy fear that we're talking about? This reverence, this awe, this understanding that if I am like, if Christ's presence is constantly with me, if I recognize that, like, how does that change how I respond in life? I know what it looks like when we don't fear God. It's easy to see what it looks like when we don't fear God. Right? When we don't fear God, it's easy to blame God. It's easy to blame Him for all the things that are going on in our life. Right? It's easy to blame Him. It's easy to question Him. It's easy to double guess Him. It's easy to say, like, you're not for me, you're not good, you don't care about me, because if we don't fear Him, it's easy to kind of just, like, kind of attribute all these things about Him, not giving credit for the things that He has done, and giving and attributing all bad things to Him, right? It's easy to respond to His blessings with sinfulness. It's easy to respond to His blessings with greed or entitlement. Right? It's really good at magnifying ourselves while devaluing His goodness. See, that's what it looks like when we don't. When we don't fear God, it's easy to kind of talk smack about somebody when we know that when we don't think He's around, right? Like there was this late night talk show host that kind of pulled this prank on the city of New York. So there's this baseball player that left the city of New York. His name is Robinson Cano, right? So he left the city of New York. He used to play for the Yankees, and he was really loved. He was really good, but then he left the city of New York for Seattle. And this was his first time back into New York. Like he went back to New York, you know, they're playing their very first game back in New York. And so what they did is they put this big box with his face on it, and he started getting people, and they started walking around, right? And I think it was like Jimmy Fallon. He starts walking around, and they were getting people to say, hey, are you going to boo Robinson Cano? Right, this guy that you feel like he was a traitor, you felt like he left you, you felt like all these things, right? Like, man, I can't believe he left us. All he wanted was more money. So they're talking all this smack about him, right? And goes, are you willing to boo Robinson Cano? He's like, yeah, I'll boo him. He goes, hey, look, we got this huge cutout of his face. Why don't you go look at that and boo him right now, right? He's like, all right, cool. Boo, boo, you suck, Robbie, boo. Right? And they turn around, he's like, is that good? He's like, yeah, boo him again. They turn around, he comes out of the box, and they're like, and you see everybody go, oh my gosh, right? And then like you see the fear in them, right? It's easy, and one of the guys goes, oh, "Welcome back to New York, Robbie," right? He's like shakes his hand. I'm a huge fan, you know. It's like, but like 1 second ago, you were booing him, right? And it's like, you see this fear. They're like, "Oh my gosh, he's actually here!" Like, right? The things that we would say and do to God, if we recognize He's actually with us, we would never do that because, like, oh my gosh, I mean, it's God. And God is actually completely, supremely, more, there's nothing wrong with Him. Like, he has no flaws, no weakness to Him. Right? You can say, like, oh, you can like, talk behind, you can say things about people, like with this baseball player, oh, maybe he is this or that. But with God, there's nothing you can say about Him. When you're in His presence, you're like, all of your criticism lay flat, because you're like, even you would know, God, like, I know those, it's not even true. But see, it's easy for us to do those things when we don't recognize and realize His presence is with us and we lack this holy fear. What does it look like if we recognize that His presence is with us at all times and for us to recognize how holy He is and how sinful we are? And I mean, can you imagine trying to debate God in, like, to His face that your way is better than His? But we do that all the time because we don't think He's around. Like, I just can't imagine if I was there, like, say, literally in front of Jesus and go, Jesus, I know that You told me to do this, but I'm telling You, man, You got it all wrong. Like, I don't think I'll have the guts to do something like that, right? But I can do it when I feel like my back is towards Him. And Paul is saying that, you see, I recognize the fear of the Lord, and this is what he does. I do what I do because I fear the Lord. And so he starts talking about these things, about how he goes and persuades others, which is like he's sharing the gospel to them. And he's hoping that they see that what he is saying is of truth. And the way he lives his life is actually a gospel-oriented life. And we're not really digging deep into that this morning, but what I want us to see that Paul is going, my motivation in life is because I fear God. Do we fear God? David Garland, in his 2 Corinthians commentary, writes, it is said that whatever it is that one fears is the one the most, that is what one will serve the most. So do we fear God enough to serve Him, or do we fear other things in life? Right, it's easy to say, let's say, I might fear the people in my workplace, so I don't talk about my faith at work. But when you fear the Lord more, it gives you confidence that I will fear the Lord over fear of man. Or maybe I fear showing weakness so I can't concede to my spouse and seek reconciliation. But when we say when I fear God more, I can happily show humility because I fear God more than I fear what people think of me or how they see me. Or maybe sometimes going, I fear for my future, so I don't know what lies ahead, so I'll sacrifice anything and everything to make sure that my future will be okay, instead of going, I fear God more, so I know that my future is in His hands. See, holy fear drives us to trust and obedience. Holy fear reprioritizes our life. Holy fear allows us to recognize that all the other fears in life doesn't pale in comparison to Him. It's a great gift because when we fear the Lord, there's nothing else we can fear in life. But it's not just that. I feel like what's amazing here is not just that. It's not just about fearing God or this holy fear, because he continues to write in verse 14, Paul says, for the love of Christ controls us. Because we have concluded this, that one has died for all, therefore all have died, and He died for all, that those who live might no longer live for themselves, but for Him, who for their sake died and was raised. And so Paul says that, yes, my motivation in life is a holy fear for the Lord, but it is like completed by Jesus' love. And so the second resolution that I want to challenge all of us this morning is, how can we respond to Jesus' love? Or maybe, how can we respond properly to Jesus' love? Right? Paul brings about that his motivation isn't just from holy fear, but from Christ's love. So R. Kent Hughes writes in the 2 Corinthians commentary, he says, fear of Christ has motivated Paul, and now Christ's love for Paul completes the motivation. Fear of Christ has motivated Paul, but Christ's love for Paul completes that motivation. I was like, that is amazing. What an amazing picture Paul is painting here. This grandness and holiness of God that brings about fear, brings about repentance, brings about respect and reverence and awe, is beautifully complemented by this intimate and personal love of Jesus. God's character brings about holy fears in His followers, and His love affirms it in us. He couples these two things that we thought might be kind of opposed to each other. He couples them and we recognize this paradox, like it actually fits in together when they were talking about God. And Paul says this, he says, Christ's love controls him. Well, I'm like, what a funny, what an odd like word for us to kind of, it's just kind of odd to hear that, right? Christ's love controls Paul. Right, so in some of your translations, you might hear the word compel and things like that. So I want to kind of talk about this word control or compel. Like what does it really mean? Right, this is the same word that means like Paul uses when he says things are being hard pressed or held together. And this word is even used for like illness in the Gospels. So it's like somebody is struck with illness, it's like they're controlled by this illness. So this word is like things are hard pressed, things are held together, things are compelled or controlled, and things are like just this huge influence in something, right? And so Paul is saying that Christ's love is this real, powerful, compelling love that just won't let Him go. It controls Him. And it's experiencing Jesus' love just changes him completely, and nothing can change. Nothing can stay the same. Everything should and must change. And Paul goes and explains what is that type of love that controls him. Essentially, what he says when he starts talking about this, he's talking about Jesus' death and resurrection for us. So he says, when one died, therefore all died. He's saying this. He's saying that when Jesus came and died on the cross, he came and died as a substitute for our penalty. So when one died, all those who have placed their faith in Jesus, and I love this, when he says all, like all kinds of people, not just the Jews, he's like the Jews, the Gentiles, the rich, the poor, all types of people, those who have placed their faith in Jesus, because they all died. That when Jesus died on the cross, he's essentially saying that he's replaced the death that we deserve. And we're not talking about a physical death. Like, not like everyone just like dropped down and died. He's talking about the spiritual death that all of us had. Because all of us have died. And he goes, concluding this, right? He says this, that those who therefore all died, and he died for all, that those who live might no longer live for themselves, but for him who for their sake died and was raised. And what he's saying is that those who died, now when they're raised, they're Jesus's. They live for Jesus. A very tangible example of this, and as confusing as this might sound, because I mean I can spend 20 minutes describing this. Just think of for a second about baptism. What's going on in baptism? Is that when it's a physical portrayal of someone dying to themselves and able to die to themselves because of Christ's death and rising again with Christ as a new person. And that's essentially what Paul is talking about. That because Jesus died and rose again, we can die to sin and rise again in him. And so what he's saying here is that you were once controlled by sin. Sin controlled you. That's the way you lived your life, right? But he says, you died to that, so when you rise again, you are now controlled by love. Are you tracking with me here? That we are now, we died for those who are in Christ. When Jesus died and paid that penalty for us, we also died there as well. Our sin died there. It lay dead there. And so when we rose again, we get to live for him. So no longer we're controlled by sin, we're controlled by love. This love that saved us from the penalty of sin. So he goes, this is the impact the gospel has on the lives of those who believe him. Right? Your life is not your own. You were bought for at a price. Therefore, honor God with your body. It is a reminder, and what Paul is saying is a reminder that your love now controls you. Christ's love, what Christ has done for you, has now deeply influenced and impacts your life. This is the impact the gospel has and should have on all those who believe. For all of us. Has the gospel impacted you in such a way where you're like, where you are able to go, all the things I do is because Christ love for me, that his love is so influential, is so motivational. It's everything I want to do is because of his love. And that's the impact of the gospel. So here's a crazy thing, right? What a great and wonderful gift here. It's so wonderful that God, it's wonderful that God is so much powerful, much more wonderful, holier, amazing than we can ever imagine. So we have, that when we are in his presence, We have this holy fear. The magnitude of this power and goodness in our heart, it causes us to tremble, but bring about great peace and security in the fear. It is about being able to rest in the strong and powerful arms of God. And his love intimately brings us to the point to know that those powerful arms come in to embrace us and not harm us. See, that's what fear and love is. We fear because we have this holy reverence and awe and understanding just how powerful, how good, how strong, how amazing he is. and here in his arms, but then knowing at the same time, these arms are not going to just crush us at any second or any moment when we fail him, but his arms are there to embrace us and love us, and just fearing God and having his love controlled by us just pairs together. Just like what R. Ken Hughes writes, that the fear of Christ motivated Paul, and then Christ's love for Paul completes that motivation. So I want us, for us this morning, what does it look like for 2017 to be a church that fears God with holy fear? A fear that is the beginning of wisdom, but also compelled, controlled by his love. Nothing can change. Nothing can stay the same anymore. Everything must change. I want to end with a story. Not really a story. It's kind of like maybe some of the things that I crossed my mind last night. So Dana's sister came in town, and I think I shared this before. Her, my sister-in-law's husband, so I guess in some sense he's my brother-in-law as well. He's also a pastor, and he's a pastor in L.A. So it's kind of cool, kind of weird, because we got, you know, two sisters who married pastors. And so Dana was spending a lot of time with her sister. You know, that she came with my nephew and nieces, and they're just hanging out, spending time together. And last night before we went to bed, Dana was sharing with me something she was talking with Elsa, her sister, about. And she asked her, she goes, "Elsa, what do you think Daniel's worst quality in life is? Or like, what's quality as a husband or whatever, right?" And so I'm in bed, right? I perk up. Kind of curious, right? Like, pastor to pastor type of thing, right? And so, like, I wonder, right? And she goes, "Yeah, and Elsa told me that, yeah, I think one of Dan's worst qualities is he's too generous." And I was like, "What the heck, man? Like, are you joking me?" It's like one of these, like, interview questions. My worst quality is I work too hard and I stay too late, right? Like, yeah. And so I'm like, and so it's like, yeah. And she shares this. And she goes, "Yeah, like, he would, like, do things like see a homeless guy on the street, pick him up and take him to Target and let him go on a spending spree." And I was like, what the heck, right? Like, yeah, it's like he'll bring like homeless people to Target and like spend like, you know, like drop $75 on him. And I'm here like listening to like, so are we talking about like the great things about him or what's bad about him, right? Like I'm not tracking with you because I kind of like forgot, right? I'm pretty sure you asked what his worst quality is and you're telling me like a really great quality, right? And so I'm like, are you joking me, right? So I'm sitting here listening. And then we're done with this, and I'm going to bed. I'm going, I am such a bad pastor. I mean, we're the same age. We do the same thing. I've never once, right? Like, are you joking me? Like, maybe, you know, Dan, I think you married the wrong guy, right? Like, this is clearly this is not working. But as I'm done, I look at that, and I go, what an amazing picture of someone who fears God and lets Christ's love, like, dictate his actions, because that is not a normal thing. That is not something anybody would cross their mind to do. Right? Like, the best that I can do is, like, maybe I'll take you out to a meal, or even easier, I'll just drop something off to you, right? Like, To bring somebody in, drive them somewhere, spend an hour plus, they go, whatever you want is yours. I'm like, that is ridiculous, right? I'm like, so many times I go, I will love you on my terms. And he goes, I will love you on your terms. And I go, what will it look like for us as believers, not to just do something like that, but to be so motivated by holy fear and by his love that we do things that are just crazy, that are just absolutely like out of our minds. Like, what does it look like for us as a church if we did that in 2017 to ask ourselves, Do I fear God? Do I let His love control my and dictate my actions? And then not just stop there and go, so God, what are you asking me to do today? And I'm asking myself that. And I'm very scared of the answer. And I'm pretty sure you are too. But what if we all did it together? What if we asked ourselves that together? Let's pray.